I next met with Dr. Alan Vanook, a leader who recently reported data from the so-called Gideon Registry study of patients with hepatocellular cancer receiving sorafenib, and he began our conversation by commenting on the reason the study was done.
The rationale is that while sorafenib worked in two different studies in hepatocellular carcinoma, the results were remarkably different across regions. So there was a benefit for patients in Europe and the U.S. in one study called the SHARP study, and there was benefit in the Asian Pacific trial as well, although the patients on each arm lived 3 or 4 months less in the Asia Pacific study than they did in the SHARP trial, which gets to the question of how can survival be so different even though there's benefit to the intervention. So the concept here is to look at the patterns of care and what patients get into the clinical trials in the first place and try to slice and dice that. So even though the criteria were the same, it's obvious that the patients in Asia are different than the patients in the U.S. We also wanted to get at how hepatologists, surgeons, and medical oncologists might have cared for their patients differently. And this was more speculative than it was based on any evidence, but we wondered about that. So in terms of answering the why do patients do more poorly in Asia, we didn't so far figure that out in Gideon. Gideon has accrued almost 5,000 patients, although I'm just reporting on the first 500 patients.
5,000, that's amazing.
Well, they aim 5,000. They have data on 3,000 so far, and they have many more in the who are accrued without the data having been mined yet.
And where are the patients from?
Across the world. So this is worldwide. And it's very ambitious, but I think it gets at the questions we really wanted to ask. We were also planning to ask a non-sorafenib question, so look at the patterns of care for patients who don't go on sorafenib, although that hasn't happened yet. So we have not gone through all the data yet to know, but it's not clear to us other than that patients are much more heavily pretreated in Asia than they are in Europe and the U.S. That might explain why they don't do as well, even though they look the same when they come into the study. The other possibility is hepatitis B, which is very common in the Asian study. So we didn't answer that question. Surprisingly, what we found is that hepatologists use sorafenib quite differently than medical oncologists.
I got to say, I was even surprised that hepatologists use sorafenib for HCC.
Well, so in parts of the world, that's who cares for HCC. And even in the U.S., there's some hepatologists doing this. These are patients being followed on transplant lists. And I'm not sure I can explain why, but medical oncologists use about a median of 500 milligrams a day of sorafenib, and hepatologists use more like almost the full dose, 800 milligrams a day. So imagine this kind of differential in dosing, even though the patients appear to be more or less comparable. In fact, the hepatologists tend to treat patients with worse liver disease than the medical oncologists. The one problem with a registry is we didn't mandate the intervals of visits, you know, how often patients were seen, or even the elements that were captured in the visits. So it looks like the toxicity profile was the same, but could there have been a reporting bias? So, for example, if surgeons see patients once a month and medical oncologists see them 3 times a month, you're likelier to report side effects and toxicities if you see them more frequently. Is that the case? We don't know. So the message is that I don't know who's right and who's wrong, or if anybody, you know, but the drug is used very differently by different doctors. And I suspect it's because oncologists treat patients to see them get benefit, and if they can't objectify the benefit, they tend to err on the side of not treating to toxicity. And hepatologists who are used to treating to eradicate hepatitis, they tolerate it. Interestingly enough, they appear to tolerate patients having side effects or being on therapy longer and more.
Do we know anything about the dose response curve to sorafenib in HCC?
We don't. And we know that pharmacologically, it's not terribly relevant for the dose either. So what we do know, the report I'll talk about shows equal toxicity, and yet the dosing is entirely different. So the other possibility is that these are just different patients, and we couldn't deduce that.
I know you're looking for variations within this data set, but one thing that struck me was the consistency. So an overall finding in the data was that most of the patients being treated with sorafenib didn't really have mets, correct?
Right.
you know, what, maybe a quarter?
I think it depended on the practitioner, but 20 to 40%.
So most of these people had inoperable, I guess, inoperable, right, you know, intrahepatic disease. I thought that was interesting. Another thing was that even though there was a difference in dosing, most of the patients did get full dose. 76%.
Yeah, most of the patients started at full dose.
So even though you saw a difference, even the oncologist mostly started with 800.
Right. The big difference in that, you couldn't have told this without seeing the slides, medical oncologists in the U.S. and in Asia used dramatically less than everybody else. That was the sort of break point.
But again, just more globally.
No, I agree.
It kind of looks like most people are trying to use the full dose.
Well, and one of the things that I pose is a question is this really real life, or is this still subject to the bias of who you choose to participate in your registry?
Yeah, that could be, but there's no doubt about that. But just, you know, on the hypothesis that maybe this represents what's going on out there. The other thing that struck me, again, just sort of globally, is that most of these patients were not child puberty.
Correct. About a quarter, 30 to 40%, which is as it should be. You wouldn't want to have a lot of patients with child puberty being treated. I would emphasize there are as many questions as answers from this, and I think there'll be subsequent presentations of looking at different aspects of this. But
you want to hear the other number that struck me?
Sure.
And again, if I understood this correctly, a substantial fraction of these people had emergent-related toxicity. I think it was 42%.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
It is.
And I mean, what would be an example of that?
Well, so that was advanced hand-foot syndrome, diarrhea. Those were the leading ones. And I would emphasize, as I will tomorrow, that I have questions about all of the AE and toxicity data. So I will put out a cautionary note that we're still trying to vet the data because we're not comfortable that we have all the reports correctly.
But I mean, just globally, in your practice, for example, do you think a third or more of these patients have major problems?
No, I think it's because we dose reduce and we are very tied in. So we see patients either every week or they get a call every week from a nurse.
Interesting.
And I think the number of AEs may be a function of as much of patients' compliance. Some patients are committed to taking the drug no matter what, but I wouldn't tolerate that much toxicity.
You know, we've been talking about serafinib for years. I started with renal cell. Obviously, the hand-foot's really interesting, but we just did this sort of series on dermatologic issues in oncology, and I found out something that I completely never kind of grasped, which is a big part of the hand-foot is like hyperkeratosis and calluses.
Yeah.
Do you think most people know that?
No, and that, I think, is more with chronic use. And with serafinib, at least in HCC, not many people stay on it for that long.
Oh, that's
long.
Interesting. So, but that's longer term.
I think serafinib in renal cell and in some other diseases, situations where it's used for the long term. The other thing, of course, with serafinib is muscle wasting.
I was going to ask you about that because I think it was Marcia Brose brought that up about serafinib for thyroid. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
And again, length of treatment?
No, so that's not clear. There was a really great paper in JCO on renal cell where they did special MRI imaging, and there's muscle wasting early. You know, it's not a function of how long they get the treatment.
Oh, that's interesting.
And there's some hand-waving about the pathway that's impacted, but it is a problem, and I think
you see that with HCC?
You know, it's hard to say. Patients with HCC have liver disease and don't do well, and they often, they don't lose weight, but that's
right,
often because they start retaining fluid. And so, yes, you do see muscle wasting, but is that disease progression or is that serafinib?
Again, Marcia Brose told me something I never heard before, which is going to the gym helps? Or at least she thinks it does?
Yeah, that I don't know. I think part of the idea is that if you exercise, you can maintain muscle mass even though you're on serafinib. Mind you, this is telling, though, this is in a renal cell population,
right,
adjuvant.
Right.
These are going to be mostly healthy people, albeit with one kidney. But
well, she was talking about thyroid, actually.
Yeah, that I don't know about. But I think serafinib is a complicated drug.
Interesting. So looking back over the last, let's say, 6 months or a year, what's happened in terms of clinical research or basic research in HCC that you think docs in practice need to know about?
Well, I think what's happened is that there have been a few negative studies, and we figured out what isn't going to work. I think...
Such as?
sunitinib, for example, doesn't work. And I think what's happened is we've done a lot of studies. Patients are going on studies, so there's an awareness that these patients can go on studies. But so far, nothing has supplanted sorafenib.
Anything in general, research-wise, that we should know about?
I think in HCC, no. There are many studies ongoing, but nothing yet that's really shown us that we're going to be changing anytime soon.
Let me ask you something about the interdigitation or combination of TACE and sorafenib. What do we know about that? Are there strategies? I mean, I know it sounds crazy. In a palliative situation, 3/4 of your people, probably more, I almost look at TACE like radiation therapy as a means of local palliation. Is that the way you look at it?
That is. And, you know, certainly if you look at the literature, there are subsets of patients who've been shown to benefit from TACE, and that's with a few lesions with certain size limitations. If you believe, as I do, that most patients with hepatocellular carcinoma get into trouble when their portal vein gets invaded, if you can prevent local tumor growth, you may very much impact that endpoint. So there was a study from Japan and Korea that looked at TACE with sorafenib.
This is the one from ASCO?
This was ASCO
2010.
Last year. And that study showed no benefit.
But was it randomized?
It was, but it was not well done insofar as if you think of how sorafenib might work, part of the issue might be the revascularization of the tumors because factors are proliferating after you embolize that would promote vessel formation. Okay. And in this study, they didn't use sorafenib for weeks until after the embolization. So it's hard to see why it would have worked.
And not combined.
And they didn't combine it. Now, there is a current study, E1208. ECOG has a TACE with or without sorafenib study that will try to get at that.
That's continuous sorafenib?
It is, except for the time immediately around the TACE when you're worried about bleeding from the arterial stick.
So do we know anything about safety?
We do. There's some pilot data, and there's built-in real-time data safety monitoring.
So, you know, I try to look at these things from the point of view of the oncologist to try to make it simpler. Would you agree that outside a protocol setting, sorafenib should not be used simultaneously with TACE, but maybe it's okay to use it once they've recovered from it?
I think that's a fair characterization. I think the problem with TACE is it causes LFT abnormalities. It may clearly change the metabolism of sorafenib, and you may get into some trouble. But I think that makes sense to use it that way.
What about the different variations of TACE and also the radiolabeled spheres?
Right. So one of the problems with TACE is that one person's TACE is not another person's TACE. And there's serospheres and therospheres. And we don't really have a safety profile of any of those things in combination with sorafenib. My view is that the study, you could ask any localized therapy, radiotherapy, TACE, with or without sorafenib, if it's going to make a difference, it should make a difference, even in a gemisch like that. The dilemma is that, for example, the classic TACE chemotherapy is cisplatin. Well, you can't get cisplatin for TACE anymore because it's a generic and the company doesn't make it anymore. So the technicalities of how to do these studies are daunting. And in fact, I suspect we may never get these studies done.
Agree or disagree, it's not rare to see turf kind of battles between the radiologist and oncologist and surgeon and the team in terms of whether they get systemic therapy or TACE or something else.
Totally true. At our center, we do radiotherapy, either therospheres or serospheres, on protocol, and all the patients come through the multidisciplinary clinic, all of them. That's by agreement. But on the other hand, the surgeons may do ablation. They may do a variety of things without getting our agreement. And if this is the case at my center, which is a pretty well-developed multidisciplinary place, it goes on everywhere. And what that, of course, makes it really hard to answer these questions. I think these questions need to be answered, let's say, by comparative effectiveness kind of research, which is not necessarily a classic randomized study because there's so many biases out there, it's going to be hard to know if you can actually get a good study on any of these issues.
You know, obviously interdisciplinary care is critical in most cancers, and I don't know, I get the feeling there's more of a disparity here than you see with a lot of the other cancers in terms of whoever gets the patient first kind of thing. You had the hepatologist involved too.
Yeah, I agree. And that's a function of hepatologists. You know, this is one of those things where they know patients are prone to HCC. They follow the patients for a long time. And I think they tend to hold on to them. So this is by far and away the toughest area we have in getting multidisciplinary agreement.
What are the situations where you feel or guidelines feel it's acceptable to go ahead and tell a patient they have HCC, treat them without tissue?
That's another area of controversy. So there are radiographic criteria called the EASL criteria, the European Association for the Study of Liver Disease. I think in some patients you can proceed. My own belief is for the most part you need tissue diagnosis. But there are exceptions. Let's say a patient without hepatitis B who has an alpha fetoprotein of over 4,000 and has a liver mass, that you probably don't need tissue. So there are some sort of niches that you can agree on. One of the issues is that in the patient who's potentially going to be transplantable, followed with chronic liver disease, there's a lot of concern about biopsying these patients and seeding malignant cells into the peritoneum. And so many folks believe that you shouldn't be biopsying those patients.
What's a typical clinical situation and overall the criteria for transplant in HCC?
So the original paper was by Mazzaferro. This was about 15 years ago that looked at patients with HCC who have no more than 3 lesions and no lesion greater than 5 centimeters, obviously without metastatic disease on workup. Those are the classic criteria. They've been expanded to what are called the UCSF criteria, interestingly enough, which allows for no tumor greater than 6.5 centimeters. Bottom line is probably it's the number of tumors that are relevant, and I think more than 3 is probably out of bounds. There are a lot of patients who get transplants who exceed those criteria, and this is sort of an allocation question, whether that's appropriate. But that's another place where sorafenib is likely to be tested to see if it can reduce the risk of relapse.
Any overall estimates, or do we know the fraction of people who are actually going to transplant?
Well, the numbers I hear are about 10% of transplants in the U.S. are done for patients with HCC.
What fraction of HCCs gets transplants?
How does that differ? A very small percent. So probably about 1% of HCCs get transplanted.
1%?
Is my guess.
Wow.
The problem, of course, is the waiting list.
Yeah.
And
that was my
and
next
they
question.
Have to live long enough to get a liver.
What is the waiting list?
So if you live in Tennessee, you might wait 6 months. If you live in San Francisco, you might wait 18 months. And we, in fact, have a paper we just published from UCSF that we call Ablate and Wait. The issue is the biology of the cancer. And so if you transplant a patient in 3 months after they're diagnosed with HCC, you may not have a sense of the behavior of that cancer.
Hmm.
If you ablate the tumor and 18 months later the patient is still suitable for transplant, then you've got a sense of the biology that it may be favorable and that may be a patient to be transplanted. Because one thing that I think is unacceptable is for patients to relapse with HCC. Because it's the case now that patients with HCC get extra points in the MELD system towards being eligible for transplant. So they actually move ahead of people without cancer. And people are dying every year on the transplant list for lack of an organ.
You might not know this, but at the recent December San Antonio meetings, Dr. Neil Spector from Duke concluded his talk on anti-HER2 therapy of breast cancer by showing a picture of himself wired up in the hospital, having just gotten a heart transplant, and asked people to please consider signing their donor cards.
Oh, that's really moving.
It was amazing.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah, it was really amazing.
Huh.
So let's flip over to pancreatic cancer. I had the pleasure of interviewing your colleague, Dr. Tempero. It was quite an experience. And I see that you have a 40-year-old patient you wanted to discuss with locally advanced pancreatic cancer. What's the deal?
Well, it would be interesting how Dr. Tempero looks at this compared to how I look at it. I think the issue with pancreas cancer is, have we just changed the paradigm in the last 6 months? And that's based on a study from Europe that looked at the combination of FOLFIRINOX chemotherapy. I would emphasize, I don't know if we've changed the paradigm, but it's sure something we have to figure out.
I guess maybe you want to comment on what they presented there at ASCO.
Right. So what they showed is in a randomized study of FOLFIRINOX, which is 5-FU leucovorin, oxaliplatin, irinotecan, compared to gemcitabine, they showed far superior survival to the combination. This is a 4-month incremental benefit to FOLFIRINOX, which is over 11 months median survival in a randomized study. This is a stunning result. Now, there's a lot
is
of
is it weird that somehow it doesn't seem stunning to me?
Well, you don't take care of the patients.
4 months, though. I mean, I know that's, you know, there's a variation.
It's a fair comment whether that's enough of a difference to rattle the tree. But if you look for the last 10 years, we've done probably 15 randomized studies in pancreas cancer where the median survival in every arm is 6 months, 6 to 6.5 months. We've not moved off the dime. And here you've got a study that has an 11-month median. So clearly it suggests there's something there. And these are in metastatic patients. Now, what about in a locally advanced patient? What about in the adjuvant setting? If you really suddenly have effective therapy, can you make a bigger difference in other patients?
Before you go into more about that, and I think it is really interesting, another conclusion they made that I thought was kind of interesting, I don't remember the exact words, but something along the lines of it was relatively well tolerated.
Right. So that's in the eye of the beholder. And they had 40% neutropenia, a fair number of febrile neutropenia. And I think some people are skeptical about the generalizability of this treatment. Are these just super selected patients? And it is very toxic.
Is that your experience?
We've actually done it in just a handful of patients, and some have done extremely well, and some have not done so well, which reflects what happens with gemcitabine, for that matter. In my view, when they do a randomized study of hundreds of patients across multiple centers, you can't dismiss the results as just a matter of patient selection. They used prophylactic growth factors. They did a variety of things that we typically wouldn't do. But I think that there's no choice but to explore this. And we've done it in selected patients. Now, if you go to the GI committee at CLGB, for example, we met a few months ago to explore what to do with this regimen. You know, just by anecdotal, we asked around the room. Most everybody had said it was fine. Patients did really just fine on it, although there were a few patients who didn't do well. We need to study this, and this will be the subject of studies. My issue is, do we need to prove that it's better than gemcitabine, or do we need to do one arm that replicates that result and then move on, using it as a backbone for other concepts?
Such as?
So the choices would be to look at FOLFIRINOX and take it apart and look at the components, although there's been a FOLFOX study that really wasn't particularly effective. But do you need the irinotecan? Well, you could ask that. There are other drugs percolating that there is excitement about. Nab-paclitaxel, for example, with gemcitabine is being studied in a randomized study. How does it fit with that? There's also what's called GTX, gemcitabine, docetaxel, and capecitabine. Where does that fit in? I think, in my view, FOLFIRINOX data trumps any of the other even phase 2 data with these other combinations. But the field needs to now explore these and see which to use as a backbone. I can't see how gemcitabine remains a backbone, though, with this data.
So let's just say you have a younger patient, which is a lot of these people with FOLFIRINOX, I'm sure that they're younger, who gets FOLFIRINOX, doesn't respond, gets gem or erlotinib, doesn't respond, then what?
Well, so hopefully on a clinical trial, you would do something like nab-paclitaxel. You might do, you know, an antibody. There's irinotecan data. But the truth is that not many patients with pancreas cancer are going to get to third line. They're not in great shape by then. And I think it's tough to keep treating these patients. I'm not convinced for most patients that combination is better than just single agent gem. But this is an area that it's really difficult to manage these patients because patients with pancreas cancer are much sicker for their given amount of cancer than, let's say, a colon cancer patient, who will often go third line, fourth line, fifth line. Pancreas cancer patients are often really in rapid decline by the time they get to that level.
Outside a protocol setting, how do you make the decision about whether or not to use erlotinib?
That's pretty easy. In our group, we essentially don't use erlotinib. My take on the Canadian study was that It had a slight incremental benefit with a fair bit of toxicity, diarrhea and acne. And so we virtually don't use it. Occasionally, patients will really ask for it, but we don't use it.
So I got to ask you, what happened with this 40-year-old? What was the deal?
Yeah, so this is a 40-year-old man who presented no back pain and presented with jaundice. So he had a head of the pancreas mass and no weight loss. So we thought he was early in the course. In my experience, patients with back pain or lesions in the center of the pancreas have a really, it's ominous because that typically means they've got extensive disease. So he clinically, we thought, was resectable in terms of not being symptomatic. But on films, when you do a pancreatic dedicated scan, we saw either cancer or inflammation. You can't necessarily tell the difference wrapped around the mesenteric vessels, which to us meant that he was conceivably resectable, but it would be not likely to get a clear margin. So we would consider him unresectable. Some people would call him marginally resectable.
You said pancreatic scan?
Right. A CT scan dedicated to the pancreas.
Okay.
And it has to do with the timing of the contrast. And so that's what we did. And in this patient, our excellent pancreatic surgeon said he didn't think he could operate on him. Or he was not inclined to operate. It would be well into the abdomen, and he didn't think he could remove it all with a clear margin.
You had tissue?
We did. We had an endoscopic ultrasound-guided biopsy through the duodenum. So we gave him FOLFIRINOX. Now, this is the poster child for when a therapy works. This patient had a substantial regression, still had an inflammatory mass, but after four cycles, there was a clear plane. And we took him to surgery, and he had just more necrosis than he had viable tumor. He had almost no viable tumor in the specimen.
How did he tolerate the treatment?
He didn't bat an eyelash.
Huh.
And his nodes were all negative, although, of course, we don't know what they were before the chemotherapy. And he had a primary resection with an R0 resection and is now getting more FOLFIRINOX on the back end.
And what did they see in terms of this thing that you'd seen on the scan?
The surgeon literally, this is our surgeon trained to Johns Hopkins, who's done many Whipples. He pages me from the OR to say, oh my God, I've never seen anything like this. And we just don't see that. I don't think we've ever seen that. Now, you see that occasionally if you'd radiated patients where you'd see a fair bit of necrosis. This is without radiation. So that's the anecdote that sort of makes you wonder, is there something there in the right patient population?
You know, it's always this issue in a lot of cancers. Can you change resectability or the way you do surgery? Do you think it's different because he had the response?
Well, you know, I don't think you do. I think the point is that he was probably technically resectable in the first place.
Right.
But that it would have been so difficult or so, you know, because of structures intervening. So I don't think you really change the disease. If you go from 8 centimeters to 4 centimeters, it was still an 8-centimeter tumor. And this patient's risk, of course, is much greater for hematologic or hematogenous spread than it is just for local disease. So the answer to your question is no. I don't think you make patients resectable who weren't initially resectable, but you may mechanically allow a different operation. And in that part of the abdomen, it may matter. Now, this patient, by no means is he home free, but it was a very remarkable result.
Now, you said that maybe your colleague, Dr. Tempero, would have handled this differently. How do you think other people might have approached it?
I think other people would have done a gem-based therapy with radiation, perhaps, a gem nab-paclitaxel. They might have done a gem docetaxel capecitabine. There are some people who believe they've seen that with those therapies. I've not. I think clearly in pancreas cancer, there's not unanimity by any means. And what there is a need to do studies. Our challenge is to agree on the studies and to get them done. And sometimes that's the bigger challenge, is figuring out what to study.
Let's talk about colorectal cancer. And these three cases look really interesting. I don't know if we can get through all three. But how about your 41-year-old, speaking of younger patients, with numerous lung and liver lesions?
Well, so the issue here that I think is very relevant is, what do you do about the asymptomatic primary? And this fellow actually, amazingly enough, was losing weight. He's otherwise healthy, 41-year-old, no family history, was losing weight, but otherwise was fine and was trying to lose weight. And really nothing special going on, and then developed right lower quadrant pain. And went into his doctor, who palpated a big liver and a mass in the right lower quadrant.
Like the old days, huh?
He didn't get a CT scan first. He actually got a diagnosis from the hands.
Wow.
And they did a CT, and he had a 7-centimeter mass in the right, in the cecum, which would be confirmed on CT and on colonoscopy. And he had 2 numerous to count lung and liver lesions.
Wow. But the primary was asymptomatic.
It was huge, but in the right colon, remember, the stool is liquid. And you can have, it was asymptomatic except for the pain, but in terms of bleeding or obstruction, it occupied about 1/2 to 2/3 of the lumen of the cecum.
So speaking of TURF, I guess a patient like this also depends who they get to first.
That's exactly right. Although in our case, this patient got to a colorectal surgeon. We work very closely with our colorectal surgeons, and the issue was whether to do surgery first or do chemotherapy first.
I mean, of course, even in community practice, maybe a surgeon seeing all these mets might want to have an oncologist take
a look. I think most surgeons in practice would say, you need an operation.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, we come in now. So this was a struggle because the patient had pain, not bowel symptoms. On the other hand, he had a big mass, and he had incurable disease. So you could argue, why start with chemotherapy? But the way I look at it is you may get one chance to give this patient chemotherapy. If you do an operation and the patient has a complication, then you may never get chemotherapy into him.
And I guess in terms of the weight loss, you could say that his mets were symptomatic.
That's how I looked at it as well. So this was a debate. There is data that's on point to this, which is looking at NSABP C10, which looked at patients with synchronous metastatic disease and primaries in place, got FOLFOX Bev, and looked to see what the likelihood of complications were, what percentage of patients went to surgery. That was presented at ASCO last year.
And of course, that was just phase two or one arm.
It was a phase two single arm where they set the bar at, we would accept up to 20% emergent surgery or major events. Now, I'm not sure I would accept 20% major events.
Well, at least to stop the trial, that's
correct.
What they were doing.
And so they,
these are asymptomatic.
Correct. Patient, I'm not sure, would have qualified because he was symptomatic, albeit not from bowel function.
Right.
So they found that 14% of patients, I think 90 patients accrued, 14% had a need for intervention. I think 8 required surgical intervention and 1 needed a transfusion maybe. And that was with FOLFOX bevacizumab. So I take that to support the idea that you can do chemotherapy, although it's a balancing act. Obviously, if the patient needs an emergent operation, then they may be left with a colostomy where they might not have needed one in the first place, or an ileostomy. And so many issues. But I take that as data that means it's acceptable to give chemotherapy. The other thing that we've all observed is almost to a person, the primary tumors melt away in these patients to the point that we actually, in this patient, I had them go in and tattoo the extent of the disease, the far extent, because we knew it was in the cecum, but I wanted to know how far up into the right colon it went, because it is amazing how this, we've actually had patients where we couldn't detect the primaries when we went back in later.
Well, why is it that important if you get that kind of response?
Well, so it's important, I think, if you get a spectacular response and you want to go in and resect the primary, so you take that off the table. So as a palliative maneuver, if a patient has well-controlled metastatic disease and they have any tumor left in the cecum, it may make sense to do an operation to take that out.
So you gave him FOLFOX Bev?
We gave him FOLFIRI Bev, which is my preference.
Right.
And he had a phenomenal response everywhere. And he's been on now 6 cycles of FOLFIRI Bev, has no symptoms. Those disappeared in the first couple of weeks, but also has had marked diminution in his lung and liver. Now, this is a problem. He's had a great response. The question is, do you go beyond that? And of course, he, a young guy, no surprise, wants surgery and wants to pick out the liver lesions and pick out the lung lesions, which I don't think we're prepared to do.
Wow. What happened to his weight loss, incidentally? He gained weight?
It turned around literally within a week.
Hmm.
And this is a thing. I think some patients with colon cancer, just it's amazing how rapidly they respond. Now, that may tell us, unfortunately, it doesn't mean that he'll have a durable response, and he may very well start progressing. This is what you worry about. A rapid responder may be somebody who would rapidly progress. And the lesson there is we've not re-scoped him, but when we repeated the CT scan, this mass that was obvious is virtually gone in the right lower quadrant.
Is there any interest in trying to study extraordinary cases like this and, I don't know, whole genome sequencing or something?
Yeah, so that's funny you should mention that. So in my study, 80405, which is chemotherapy with bevacizumab or cetuximab, one of the correlative science studies I'm doing with one of my colleagues is we're taking the extremes, the patients who do really well and the patients who do really poorly, and we're doing selective sort of genome analysis to see if there's any clues as to, you know, we think if you take the extremes, that's where you may have the best chance of finding an important genetic mutation or polymorphism.
Any hypotheses or guesses?
No, not yet. But could it be a particular mutation in BRAF or something like that? I don't know. By doing the same technique, we would look, for example, who gets oxaliplatin neuropathy earlier rather than later. I think taking the extreme patients is an efficient way of doing genome analysis rather than doing it in all 2,000 patients.
Let's talk about your 47-year-old man, synchronous rectal cancer and liver mets.
Right. So this is the most complicated curable patient we'll see in GI cancer because this is a patient who, to cure him, you're going to need chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, and more surgery. And it's a real balancing act to know how to proceed.
So how did he present?
So he presented with rectal bleeding, just of a few months, a vigorous guy, no family history, and just on routine staging had two liver mets in the right lobe of the liver. And he had a bulky primary, right maybe 4 centimeters, 5 centimeters above the anal verge.
Nodes?
Looked like he had a node on endorectal ultrasound. So this is one of those cases where if you put 5 people in a room, you'd get 6 different views of how to manage it. And it was a very tough call, a very knowledgeable family who went all over looking for opinions. And the issues were not only which chemotherapy, but do you use bevacizumab or not? Do you use cetuximab or not? You know, all of these moving parts.
His KRAS?
Well, so that was interesting. So he was biopsied in the community where they didn't get enough tissue. So before we started treatment, we re-endoscoped him, recolonoscoped him to get tissue, and he was KRAS wild type.
I assume the other patient was KRAS wild?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So from the surgeon's point of view, at presentation, could he have been resected, both the primary and the liver, in one shot?
Yeah. So the answer was yes, although it would have been a long case, and we easily agreed that that wasn't what we would do.
And just in general, where are you today on the issue of neoadjuvant therapy of surgically resectable liver mets?
Well, so that depends on a lot of variables. So in synchronous patients, I firmly believe that almost without exception, they should have neoadjuvant therapy.
Again, synchronous with the primary being asymptomatic.
Primary is an asymptomatic primary. I think a symptomatic primary, if it's a solitary met and an easy resection, I think you can do both at the same time. So if you're operating on them and it's a chip shot, let's say a left lateral segment or something, I would resect it. I think the point is if you've got multiple liver mets or an asymptomatic primary, the issue is where's the disease going to be in 3 or 6 months? And to make a big difference, you have to assume chemotherapy will need to be effective. So I think the pendulum has swung back and forth a little bit. But in this patient with 2 liver mets, a bulky rectal primary, which would have been a big case and probably more than the surgeons felt would have been done in one sitting, we elected to start with chemotherapy.
Which was?
Which was FOLFOX by itself.
FOLFOX by itself. Why no Bev?
Well, so if you really look at the literature, Bev doesn't really increase the response rate all that much of FOLFOX. And the liver mets were resectable, technically. The primary was resectable. I was looking more for a bioassay that chemotherapy could work. Then I was looking for a dramatic response because the surgeon thought she could do the operation without an APR, so thought she could leave him with a sphincter. So my view was we didn't need to maximize our chance for response. I just wanted to see if there was activity. And this is a patient I thought if he had, remember he presented with bleeding. If he bleeds and we need to do something emergent, then then have we lost the entire battle?
Right.
Now, we debated cetuximab. Turns out this is a guy who's totally appropriate and didn't want acne. And although he said, if it's going to make the difference between life and death, I'll take acne.
But it seems kind of unusual for somebody with metastatic disease who's 47.
Yeah. So, but, you know, it is what it is.
Interesting.
And the other issue, of course, was we never went to the steps of trying to get it approved because cetuximab technically isn't on label for frontline metastatic disease.
Do you believe that in KRAS wild tumors, there's a higher response rate to, let's just say, chemo cetuximab to chemo Bev?
No. I think they probably are very comparable. But I think the advantage of cetuximab in this setting is you don't have to worry about the timing of surgery and the complications. Not common with Bev, but if you get a complication, you can really get a major complication.
Do you think that, I'm going to guess there may be some people out there who might have somehow integrated radiation therapy into this, and it seems kind of weird, but I think maybe they might have?
They would have, for sure. In fact, in the community, they'd already put the tattoos on to do chemo radiation. And the reason I didn't do radiation up front was that I felt down the road he needed to see a lot of chemotherapy. And once you radiate the pelvis, my concern was that you'd lose a marrow capacity and we might have trouble getting chemotherapy into him.
I mean, do you think you could make an argument that you want to do the radiation or combine chemo radiation to prevent, you know, not so much to help curate, but prevent out of control local problems?
Right, for sure. So I didn't take radiation off the table, but we didn't use it up front.
Right,
so,
just for now.
Turned out we pushed the right buttons. So the way we hoped to do it was chemo, show that the disease either shrunk or was not progressing, which at four cycles it hadn't. He had a little fatty liver, which, and it turns out he wasn't eating very well. He was a bit of a junk food guy. So his LFTs were a little off. We stopped at four cycles of FOLFOX. We then did a liver resection. We resected his liver mets. They were resectable. We thought that was the operation we should do first.
Did his primary respond?
His primary responded. Didn't disappear, but responded.
So you didn't take it out because it was too big of an operation?
Correct. We thought we would do one or the other. We took the liver mets out. We then gave him a few more cycles of FOLFOX and then gave him chemo radiation to the rectum. And then after chemo radiation, resected his primary and then put four cycles of FOLFOX on the back end.
And he's currently NED and doing well?
Well, this started in September of 2009, so he's a year and a half out. He's about 16 months out, free of disease.
Wow. Any data sets that have come out in the last year in terms of the issue of hepatic-only mets?
I think no is a short answer. I think the question of who to resect and who not has evolved actually to the question of whether debulking liver mets is of benefit. So interestingly enough, I think surgeons and interventionalists are pushing the envelope as far as who they're going to consider these operations for. And the question has come up, is it a palliative operation? And so what's recently been published is not so much on the cure rate, but do you prolong survival in these patients?
A palliative operation.
A palliative partial hepatectomy.
Why does that sound a little difficult?
It does. But I would bet, in fact, if you look at the survival data on the contemporary studies, which has patients with advanced colon cancer living 24 months or 26 months, 25% of them go to liver resection, although they die of metastatic disease. And I believe that probably in some patients it does prolong their lives to resect metastatic disease. Now, whether it's appropriate or not is a different question. Whether you should operate on somebody who you don't think is resectable is a different question.
So final question, getting back to the patient who has surgically resectable hepatic mets, this controversy about neoadjuvant therapy or not. First, what do you tend to do in your own practice? And second, what's the status of the big trial trying to look at this?
Yeah, so if it's resectable and a patient's had adjuvant therapy, for example, we tend to just resect. And then the issue is what do you do after that? And that's a very tough question. So I'm talking about a solitary met, we resect.
So no neoadjuvant therapy.
Almost without exception, a solitary met will resect.
And you're saying there's a question about whether to use systemic therapy after?
Right. So if the patient's seen FOLFOX, And then progresses. Do you use FOLFIRI?
As sort of pseudo-adjuvant?
Right. And there's no data.
I mean, most people in practice use something.
Absolutely
right. Do you do that?
Well, so what we typically do is in patients with not solitary mets, we'll use FOLFIRI for 2 to 4 cycles. And if we see either stable disease or response, we use it on the back end. But many patients want their surgery right away. They've already been at this for a while, in which case it's a tough discussion, but we typically don't offer them therapy on the back end.
Hmm. How about
and in
the
terms
trial?
Of the trial, that's problematic. The negative AVANT data from the oxaliplatin bevacizumab combinations,
adjuvant,
showing no benefit, and in fact, raising the concern that there may be a deleterious effect of bevacizumab later on in patients in the adjuvant setting.
In terms of tumor recurrence?
Well, in terms of sort of the behavior of the disease after it recurs.
Hmm.
It's only been released in press release, but if you read between the lines, there's always been the theoretical concern of sort of an escape from bevacizumab phenomenon.
But wasn't that presented at ECHO?
They did present... They didn't present this precise aspect of it. But because of that, the Bev has been removed from C11.
So this is a NSABP trial?
Correct. NSABP C11. And what it is resectable liver mets, FOLFOX, pre-op followed by surgery followed by more FOLFOX, or surgery followed by FOLFOX.
Now, when was the study opened?
It was opened maybe 6 months ago, but then closed. I'm not sure that there's been any accrual, because they had to delete the bevacizumab.
Right, because I know initially that trial was using Bev.
Right, and that's a hot issue, but again, the consensus has been that with the evolving data with bevacizumab, that it's not appropriate to use it in these patients.
Interesting. Anything new, incidentally, in terms of genomic markers? There was this report of, quote, the oncotype colon. I don't think it's been published, has it?
It hasn't been, and CLGB, we just did a study looking to see if we could validate it with another subset of stage 2 patients. I believe at this meeting there will be a poster on a cost-effectiveness model for Oncotype DX colon, and I believe that Agendia is presenting data on their assay.
Is this MammaPrint or something different?
That's ColoPrint.
ColoPrint.
Right. And then there's the other thing that's circulating is guanyl cyclase C, GCC. This is an analysis of fresh lymph nodes, which has been published. Dan Sargent is one of the authors that suggests that that's another marker for node-negative patients who have this molecule in the lymph nodes are at higher risk for recurrence.
Am I correct in saying that you actually can order the Oncotype colon now?
You can.
I think that's the only one you can, right?
That's the only one that's on the market, and I understand that they're selling a surprising number of them.
Do you think there's a role for it?
We're actually doing a study, and there are studies being done. At UCSF, we're doing a study where we're looking at, there are two ways to look at it. One, how does it change management? And two, what would it take for people to make changes in decision? So the study we're doing at UCSF is taking real-life cases with real-life recurrence scores and posing them to community oncologists and to academic oncologists, particularly those on the NCCN guidelines panels, to see what they would do with a given recurrence score in a given patient. Because the problem is the recurrence score ranges from 12 to 21%. What's a high enough score to justify chemotherapy? Because it doesn't tell you whether they'll get more or less benefit from chemotherapy. It just quantifies their risk of recurrence.
Of course, oncologists have been hearing about this for a long time in breast cancer and are kind of used to that. And that may be why.
That's why they use it.
That's why they're using it. But they're used to the idea, as you said, about trying to predict whether chemo is going to help, not prognosis. And in the original presentation, it kind of seemed like that sort of was the case, that you could sort of predict the absolute benefit.
Well, so this was with 5-FU, right? This was the original, these are old studies, not with FOLFOX. But what their data suggested is that everybody got the same relative benefit. From the 5-FU. So in fact, yes, you could say the relative benefit is the same, and if the risk is less or more, then there may be more reason to use it at the higher risk of recurrence than the lower risk. But, you know, patients are really into numbers, and doctors really like to put numbers down on a piece of paper to give patients the parameters.
Well, I think that's because of breast cancer. They got used to it.
I think you're absolutely right.
And, you know, we've actually talked to patients. And as you said, they're not everybody, but there are people out there. I mean, the same as breast cancer, who want to know the numbers.
Right. And I think there's some comfort in numbers, except, of course, that it doesn't tell you at all what that patient's going to do.